Good evening, everybody. My name is Tony Giddens. I'm very pleased to welcome you to this series of lectures on the world in 2000. I've come here, I have to say, to introduce the series, but unfortunately I can't stay for this particular one. But I'm very happy that this series of lectures is happening. As a background to it, can I cast your minds back, well, not your mind, mentally back to the end of the last century, and just over 100 years ago. At that time, there was a lot of optimism about what can be achieved in the world. It was a period, in some respects, eerily like the one that exists now. Some people call it the first stage of globalization, the end of the 19th century. There were open markets, there was plenty of trading goods, there was trading currencies. People were speaking about the end of the nation state or the end of political boundaries. In lots of cases, people didn't need passports to travel across the world. There was mass migration from country to country. And at that point, a lot of people believed that some kind of world civilization was possible, and there were many discussions of world government, the transformation of international relations at that time. Everybody, of course, knows the horrific history of the 20th century, which completely failed to bear out those anticipations. Now we stand at the beginning of a new century or millennium, if you like, with the same kind of hopes coming about again, I think. A more globalized world, the apparent breakdown of some traditional structures, the seeming decline of the nation state, to some extent a new period of the end of ideology, or some people say so. So that many of these hopes have come alive again for us. At the same time, I live in a world of obvious risks because the world is highly interdependent. The more interdependent the world is, the more risky future is as well. So you have a balance of optimism and risk. If you look at, for example, the impact of information technology is transforming the world economy, but no one knows what it will lead to. No one knows what the downside of it might actually be, and the same thing applies to a whole range of ecological questions, ethnic conflicts, divisions across the world. Well, these things, this balance between potential optimism and the looming threat of risks that face us is going to be the kind of backdrop to the lectures which Professor Halliday will give, and which is starting this evening. Fred Halliday is not only one of the most distinguished professors at the LSE, he's one of the most distinguished scholars in two fields in Middle Eastern studies. I can bear witness to this, having accompanied him on a trip to Kuwait recently, where I gave a lecture and he translated this lecture subsequently into fluent Arabic. I couldn't understand the Arabic, but I could understand people's faces, and whatever he said made sense to them. And He was very impressive on this trip. And of course, he's very well known for his wider thinking about the field of international relations. This series of public lectures has been organized jointly with Macmillan, and I was very pleased to see Steve Kennedy and other old friends and colleagues of mine from Macmillan here tonight. The series then will explore some of these basic issues that face us, and I'd like to ask you to welcome Professor Halliday for the first lecture in the series. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony, very much for that introduction. What Tony didn't tell you was that during his visit to Kuwait, he gave a couple of lectures on globalization and the third way. And he'd handed out his CV beforehand in Arabic, and the first questions tended to be about the changing role of the state or the world economy or markets. But very soon the questions became about Newcastle United, Chelsea, Arsenal, and so forth. And he found that this was a global language with which he could conduct business there with virtually everybody that he met. I'd like to begin by thanking the LSE conference organization, and also Macmillan's for allowing me to give these lectures this evening and for sponsoring them. But I'd also like to address a question which a discriminating and polite colleague asked me this afternoon. Basically, she said, what on earth is this venture? To put it politely, what's the occasion for all this? And the occasion for these lectures is, in the first instance, an LSE series which has been going on for the past few months called Spanning the Century, which is obviously taking the occasion of the millennium to look at a number of social science issues. And while the millennium itself is not and was not a date of great significance, I think many have pointed out that the really major rupture in recent history was 1989, not 2000. I think it is an occasion for some stock-taking, and that's what I want to try and do. There is an interesting social science point about the year 2000, however, which is this, that prior to the 1st of January, there was enormous speculation on what machines were going to do, the whole question of Y2K. And as we know, virtually nothing happened. But what the social scientists and the press didn't predict was what human beings were going to do. And it was a small but interesting point in the week after the 1st of January that large numbers of couples broke up. People chucked each other out over the occasion of the millennium. So while we failed to predict what machines would do, we also failed to predict what humans could do. And I'm sure there is a moral in all of this. If I were to sum up the purpose of these lectures, it would be that they are an attempt to defend what I would call international reason. That is, first of all, reason in the sense of the possibility of reasoning, both analytically reasoning and also morally reasoning, about international affairs, and not just yielding it to emotion or prejudice or to the press, and of having, in the context of that reason, some measured, cautious, perhaps doubtful, but nevertheless persistent discussion of what the options we face are. I'm not a great believer in prediction where human affairs are concerned, except perhaps with regard to demography. But I do think that some reasoned discussion of where the world is going and where it might go and what one might do about it is possible. But secondly, this is international reason. And I mean that in the sense of discussing the affairs of the world's 195 states and of the thousands of different ethnic, linguistic, and religious groups in it, discussing it in terms that are, to a limited degree at least, shared between them. I do not believe in what I call fault line babble, the idea that the world is divided up into incommensurable civilizations, discourses, or religions. And I would take as the motto of this lecture series Schiller's point in his work on the Education of Man, where he said, one is just as much a citizen of one's age as a citizen of one's state. And if that was true 200 years ago, I would argue it is true today. Well, as befits a millennial moment, let me begin on a note of some optimism. We have, I would suggest, four good reasons for being optimistic, and more optimistic than in recent decades, about the course of today's international system. I would indeed defend a measured, modest, but measured concept of progress. First of all, since the end of the Cold War, we no longer live under the shadow of a global strategic rivalry that brought with it the danger of nuclear annihilation and indeed the annihilation of humanity. We might recall the phrase of the famous French sociologist and international relations theorist Raymond Aron, who described the Cold War in these terms. He said, "Paix impossible, guerre improbable." Peace is impossible, but war is improbable. I think we live in a world today in which peace is possible. Paix is possible, and guerre is also possible, of course. But this is an advance and an important one, which for the foreseeable future we should remain thankful for. Secondly, we live in an era of unprecedented economic growth. Over the past 50 years, global GDP has increased ninefold, from $3 trillion to $30 trillion. Average per capita incomes worldwide have risen more than three times. And the percentage of the world enjoying what is termed medium human development has risen from just over a half, around 55%, to 66%, to two-thirds. There is good reason, moreover, to expect that these levels of growth in world GDP can and will continue for the foreseeable future. And this economic growth is accompanied by the formation of new institutional forms, new trading areas with political concomitants, of which the European Union, a unique and far from inevitable success, is the most striking example. Thirdly, we no longer live in a world riven by fundamental ideological division. or equally importantly in my view, by one of incommensurable or non-communicable value differences. There is plenty of variety and dispute in the world, for the sound reason that traditions and cultures and interests vary. But these divisions are framed and argued out in terms that are broadly shared, in terms of independence, in terms of popular and national sovereignty, in terms of rights, in terms of economic prosperity. There is, if I may say so, as a result of the diffusion of the values of the American and French revolutions and the participation of peoples across the world in movements of protest over the last 200 years, there is a shared global ethical language. The dispute is not about the language, it's what to say in it. There is no culture, no people in the world who are against the principle of national self-determination or against the right to economic development, just as there is no nation which refuses to participate in the World Cup. Finally, and fourthly, we see no end to what has historically been the core of science, if much abused, or progress, which is, although much abused, which is the advance of science and technology. The last century saw plenty of abuse of science by states, and the next one promises, on current form, to see much more abuse by private interests. One need only note covert work in genetic surgery on human beings, which has already got out of control in some countries. There is enormous and justified concern about how this knowledge will be distributed. But the ability of science to transform our lives, to transform our bodies and our health, does hold out enormous potential for humanity as a whole. Increases in lifespan are evident around the world, and dramatic new developments are on the way. The 21st century promises, if nothing else, to be the age of biology, just as the 19th was the age of chemistry and the 20th the age of physics. So much for the good news, or the potential for good news. And let me now turn to the challenges this poses. As Tony Giddens just said, it's necessary, especially at a time of widespread complacency, I would say widespread hegemonic complacency, to strike a note of warning. The last century began on a note of optimism and of progress, only to founder within a few years. And we would be wise to recall such a confounding of human expectations. The present period of international relations, irrespective of the millennium, is one with many dangers. And it's also one in which many trends are uncertain. The way to sell a book on international relations today and to command a wide audience is to come up with some grand, confident thesis about the new world order, the end of history, the clash of civilizations, the new Middle Ages, and so on. I've got a count of about 15 of these. The problem is, without being postmodernist about it, there isn't one grand narrative at the moment. The new world order is a cant phrase, largely used now only by conspiracy theorists, and I shall return to some of the other claims later on in these lectures. But we do not have at the moment a coherent shape for the post-Cold War world, for the pattern of great power relations, and for the uncertainties to which the world economy is vulnerable. There are also a range of destructive forces: inter-ethnic conflicts, economic inequality, the spread of illegal trades in drugs and weapons, the rise of disease in various forms, which appear to be growing. At the same time, we are all 6 billion of us, in my view, to a greater or lesser extent, in forms of denial about what is happening to the environment. All of these considerations can justify and indeed stimulate some broader reflection on where the world may be headed. If I had to put a title to it, I would say that we live in the age of the great opportunity. Many things are open, and human agency can make a difference. Nor are we sure about what we should be looking for. But the debate is not just about what is happening, but about which trends may be more significant. And here I would suggest the October 1999 test. This was a month in which we saw two of the most ominous and perhaps important developments in recent international social and political life, and ones which, by the time we get to 2050, could be of decisive importance. One side of this was what Eric Hobsbawm points to in his own contribution to the millennium, the new century. Because he says it was in October 1999 that the world's population passed the 6 billion mark. But October 1999 was also the year in which, the month in which the US Congress rejected the Comprehensive Tasman Treaty. The question which we must confront is which of these developments, the rise in the world population to reach 10 billion by the year 2050, or the possible proliferation of nuclear weapons out of the regime which is roughly held up to now, which of these is more significant for the future? And it's against this background of uncertainty that I want in this lecture to look in more detail at some, I stress some of the challenges we face in discussion of the contemporary international system. And I divide these challenges into two groups, the intellectual challenges and the challenges to policy. The argument that I put for international reason suggests not only that we can talk meaningfully about the second, policy challenges, but that our discussion of the first group, the intellectual, could, and I only stress could, bear some relevance to the second. Let me begin with the intellectual challenges. The first is what I call global paranoia. The greatest threat to our understanding of the world for those in power, and one only has to read The Economist or the Herald Tribune or listen to the world's radios to see this, is complacency. But the other side of this, the threat from below, is what I call the diffusion of myth, of paranoia, the misuse of historical explanation and example, and much of the sheer rancorous, but in my view, rather fruitless nonsense which we encounter in discussion of the international system. This, I would argue, is one of the least studied aspects of globalization, a trend to conspiracy theory, to paranoid simplification, which has its historical roots, as all such distortions do. It first promoted, I think, by colonialism, given a great new lease of life by the Cold War, and now rehashed in current globally wired form by the culmination of globalization. Paranoia, not financial markets, are, one could argue, the highest stage of globalization. Now, every discipline involves engagement with some forms of distortion, myth, and irrationality. Indeed, it's one of the functions of an academic discipline to identify and counter such myths. It was, after all, Francis Bacon in his great scientific work who argued that we must fight against and identify the various idols that beset the minds of men and women. But as we all know, international relations is no laggard in this respect. One need only look at the press of any country, not least this one, or the speeches of politicians, or catch what attitudes are expressed about other peoples in everyday contexts, on chat shows, in pubs, buses, taxis, and the like, on the front pages of many of the newspapers, to realize what a mass of prejudice and myth prevails about matters international. Now, in Western Europe, prone to complacency as we are, we like to think that this is only a problem for other peoples. It's the Serbs who are obsessed about Muslims and Turks, or the Chinese who are enraged about the bombing of their Belgrade embassy, or Muslims concerned about Western conspiracies. But of course, this is far from being the case on the right or on the left. As far as the right is concerned, in this country, we need only listen and read what significant portions of the press have to say about Brussels or about the Germans. We can look, on the other hand, at what much of the European left thinks about the United States, or indeed what many in the United States think about the United Nations or about international adjudications that go against them. I wouldn't want to detain you too long about the conspiracy theories about the death of Princess Diana, TWA 800, the death of Kennedy. And to these myths of conspiracy, there are also those, more specifically, of national enmity and simplification. But the British press, and increasingly the TV, happily replicate these with regard to Germans, French, Muslims, and the like, and those of other countries are in many ways not much better. The second intellectual challenge I would like to discuss is that of risk. We have to take account not only of the opportunities, but also of the risks involved in the changing system of international relations. Risk is one of the most discussed topics in the social sciences today. It's generally held that in certain crucial respects, this has increased in recent decades, be it in regard to health, to financial calculation, or to physical security on our streets. Some time ago, I attended a discussion of academic specialists on risks from different disciplines, and they all plied their wares, the economists, the sociologists, the psychologists, the accountants, and so on. I let them speak and then made the pitch from international relations. They were all talking about risk, and properly so. But the greatest risks are arguably the ones dealt with in the international field, and which international relations has been discussing for some decades past. These include the risks of miscalculation in foreign policy crisis, the risks involved in intervention or not intervening in the domestic conflicts of other states, and above all, the risk receded but not entirely disappeared of nuclear war. To these dramatic short-term forms of risk, we can add others. The risks involved in not addressing the long-term degradation of the global environment or in allowing the gap between rich and poor to increase every decade. The third international challenge I would address is that associated with the interrelation of societies, or to give it a more technical term, interdependence, a word, by the way, which has been in use since the 1840s. The question of how we understand the impact of our everyday lives on our own societies, on our health of the international system, as well as on our politics, is a central one. And to a degree perhaps never the case before, people in every country of the world are conscious of the way in which their lives, in multiple manners, are affected by what goes on beyond the frontiers of their own state. Two interesting examples from today's paper. One is the debate in the United States in the run-up to the presidential election. Education has become the central question. Some people say by default. But there's another reason, which is that calculations of performance of 18-year-olds in maths and science has become a visceral national issue because of international comparison, because of the sense that others out there in the Far East or Hungary or whatever it may be are performing better than they are. And I think much the same can be said about the education debate in this country. It's as much as anything a debate not about educational achievement as such, not about social equality, but about international competition. Secondly, we have the rather surprising development that the leading candidate for the post of Mayor of London has come out in favour of the euro and is denouncing Downing Street for dithering on this issue because he says he speaks for the City of London. Well, I don't agree with him on many things, but on this issue I suppose I do, and it's interesting that he should have seen fit to come up with this question. So, to some extent, we are living in a world where people are more aware of and talking about these international influences. And in regard not only to the environment, not only to the economy, not only to the spread of political ideas, but in regard to food, music, clothes, gender roles, health, the expectations of students about how long it would take for their essays to be returned, and much else, the forms and changing forms of communication we live in are increasingly united. But I have some caution about this in three respects. First of all, we should not exaggerate the degree to which the world really is united, to what extent it really is a global village, whether it's wired up or not. On any index you take, be it food, investment, or language, the world remains a diverse and to a considerable degree fragmented place. We hear a lot about foreign investment, but 80% of foreign investment goes into the OECD countries. Most of world trade is between a group of richer countries. I would also disagree about the novelty of this interconnectedness. Indeed, my one recurrent and underlying disagreement with the colleagues who work on globalization is they tend to understate the degree to which the phenomena they're talking about are ones which were present in the past. There is an exaggeration of the novelty of the present. It is a conceit of the more developed and hitherto insulated countries that the interconnection of societies is a recent development. In international relations, people began talking in the 1970s and 80s about interdependence. But for most countries in the world, they have been buffeted and ravaged, indeed occupied, by other states over the 19th and 20th centuries. For over 90% of the world, for all indeed except the UK, Canada, the USA, and one or two other countries, this experience of vulnerability is not new. And even those countries had shown that they were more than vulnerable in the crash of 1929 and in the world wars. Societies were never as insulated as the current myth about globalization would suggest. I think, thirdly, there is a danger of a new myth about interconnectedness complementing that of paranoia. It's the myth of passivity, the myth that we as individuals or as institutions, in this case universities or as states, are passive objects of global trends. A considerable realm of choice remains. And what this choice is, what we make of it, and how we organize, perhaps collectively or individually, to confront it, is to me one of the central questions of our time. This leads me to the fourth and last of the intellectual challenges, perhaps the most important of all. Because in analyzing the international system, we also analyze the choices which are involved, the options we have, and therefore the moral issues that underline them. As with Bacon's Idols of the Mind, and as with risk, so with choice, this is of course something that pervades all of human activity. But those idols pertaining to the international and the choices concerning them are arguably also of immense proportion. War, humanitarian intervention, much debated these days, migration, the world economy, the environment, human rights, to name but some of these issues. Yet the range and depth of these issues contrasts, I think, with an almost wholly impoverished and again simplified ethical language in much public debate. Everybody has strong views about morality in international affairs. Something has to be done, everyone else is a blackguard or a traitor or a sellout, and everyone is quick to justify their own side with various forms of self-righteousness. Indeed, both distinctive and modular forms of denunciation can be found in the discussion of international relations. So if moral indignation is rather out of fashion in domestic affairs, it seems to be on the up in interregional and international affairs. One only has to think of some recent examples in this country, the debate on Pinochet, or on the asylum bill, the World Trade Organization, BMW, or BSE. Again, we should not think that progress towards greater integration, modernity, or globalization have brought all this to a nice, consensual, globally convenient end or agreement. If anything, the challenges of globalization make the argument sharper. What do we think about the solution to the question of migration? What do we think about environmental burden sharing? What do we think about humanitarian intervention or the adjudication of trade disputes? If we look at these issues in public debate in Western Europe, or in Britain in particular, or in French-British relations about mad cow disease, we can see there is a high level of moral import, but very little clarity, let alone looking further afield at the clamor over Kosovo, or Chechnya, or Palestine, or the Kurds, or the Tibetans, or Timor. So indignation and accusations of conspiracy and perfidy run very high, but evenness of argument, let alone a dose of self-awareness and self-criticism, seem to run very low. Here I'd like to put in a word for a much-abused writer, Mr. Salman Rushdie, in his novel The Satanic Verses, a passage which I think probably caused more offense than any other, where the angel asks, what is the greatest of all virtues? And of course, the orthodox answer is, the greatest of all virtues is faith. And the reply is, no, it isn't faith, it's doubt. And I think there's some room for more doubt in the public discussion of international issues than we have seen in public debates in this country in recent years, and I would say in others as well. The possibility of considering other points of view and of arguing more precisely for one's own point of view has been very much in recession. So much for what I take to be the main intellectual challenges of thinking about the contemporary world. Let me now move on to the political challenges in what is frequently, but in my view erroneously, referred to as the real world. Let me begin by discussing the question which has been central to international relations since its establishment, but is rather on the margins today, which is the question of war. Speculation about the new millennium has tended to stress the positive future. A world without war, fueled by economic prosperity, by the internet revolution, by interactions of peoples, and much else. If it has expressed a note of concern, it has been more about global economic inequality than about the danger of war. For example, the very perceptive Financial Times correspondent Martin Wolf wrote in, I think, one of his final columns of the last century, that if there's one thing he would wish to see in the future, it would be the reduction of global inequality. Now, that's fine, but there is one wish that is arguably even greater than that, and which take precedent over all others, which is peace. The dangers of war and the need to think clearly about them have not disappeared from the world horizon. We may be living on the edge of a new, peaceful, globalized era. We may, however, be living in an interregnum, a time when the dangers of war have receded, only later to return. A generation from now, our successors may look back at us with contempt and see us as living in a fool's paradise. Military power remains central to any system of international order or law, to maintain peace within and between states, and where just and legally voted for, to implement the will of the international community against aggressors within and between states. Those who criticize particular actions by Western states or the UN are themselves quite happy to argue for other actions which they claim the West is not doing. So the possibility and morality of action across frontiers for humanitarian or security reasons is, I would argue again, part of a shared international discourse. The political and moral issues inherent in the use of force have not and will not go away. Now, if we look at the dangers of major or global interstate war, then it's certainly the case that in the form in which the last century knew them, major interstate military competitions have receded from the world, and particularly from Europe. The kinds of war that broke out in 1914 or 1939, or which nearly broke out during the crises of the Cold War, are not, on present evidence, heading for a return. The Western European states are embedded in the EU and NATO, And Russia, for all its criticism of the West, is not able or apparently willing to enter a serious strategic competition again. Indeed, Mr. Putin seems to be lining up for some kind of compromise. Some years from now, that could change. But the signs are that this is not an inevitable or proximate danger. The situation is, however, rather different with regard to other areas of the world where interstate rivalry has not receded at the end of the Cold War, and where new forms of weaponry, particularly in regard to the accuracy of missiles and the availability of weapons of mass destruction, allow greater possibilities for states to take military action. And there are three such areas evident in the world today: in the Far East, in South Asia, and in the Persian Gulf, all of which, of course, have been the sites of war in modern times. The first shots of the great interstate wars of the 20th century were fired in 1894-5 in the First Sino-Japanese War, and the region was the scene of terrible destruction in World Wars I and II, and in the latter case, in World War II, of course, involved the one and only use of nuclear weapons in a war. During the Cold War, by far the bloodiest conflicts were seen in the Far East, in the Chinese Revolution, the Korean and Vietnamese wars. Today, the Far East is the scene of great economic growth and prosperity, but it would be naive to assume that this alone will stay the hand of war. It is simply not plausible to argue that economic prosperity and structures alone will constrain states from taking military action if they have other reasons for doing so. In China, we see the rise of a new sentiment of nationalism linked to a strong sense of grievance against the West and against Japan, and fueled by the crisis in the hitherto dominant ideology of Marxism. Inevitably, as the hold of communism fades, it could be replaced by other mechanisms of control and manipulation, by corruption and connections and money instead of party discipline, and by nationalism instead of the thoughts of Marx, Lenin, and Mao Zedong. The institution which is gradually replacing the party as the mainstay of the regime is the army. Now, of course, regional experts will enter a note of caution here. China is spending less as a percentage of GDP on the military now than it was 5 or 10 years ago. But that, of course, is because Chinese GDP has risen so much. It is still spending over 5% of GDP, about $38 billion, and its capability for using missiles and for longer-range naval deployment is rising. And the danger lies, of course, above all, in regard to the question of Taiwan. China has threatened to go to war if Taiwan declares independence, and it is increasingly able to inflict damage on that country without mounting the mass amphibious operation across 100 miles of the Taiwan states that certainly remains beyond its grasp. Missiles and satellites give it the ability not only to hit targets on Taiwan, but to locate and threaten any other ships, US or Japanese, that were sent to Taiwan's support. In East Asia, there is also the unresolved question of Korea. North Korea is in a precarious situation. Its political leadership evades analysis. It could continue in this state for many a year yet. Equally, it could implode as a result of factionalism within the regime. Sooner or later, it is plausible to argue, Korea will go the way of other countries divided in the Cold War, of Germany or Yemen, and will lead to the absorption of the weaker socialist by the stronger capitalist path. But in the meantime, a situation of great uncertainty prevails. South Asia represents a second zone of potential interstate conflict. India and Pakistan have already fought three wars. The province of Kashmir, partitioned between them, remains not only in dispute, but the scene of recurrent violence for which both states, I repeat, both states, must bear responsibility. In India and Pakistan, there are also strong nationalist and confrontational forces at work. In the former, because of the rise of a Hindu nationalism in the 1990s that threatens non-Hindus inside India itself, and which espouses a militaristic view of Hindu culture. In the latter, because of growing fragmentation and violence within the country, fueled by Islamic fundamentalists, drug dealers, and political corruption. The prime responsibility for this situation in recent years lies clearly, however, with India, which in May 1998 exploded a nuclear bomb and led Pakistan to follow suit. I am, and I'll come back to this in general terms, sympathetic to what the current British government has sought to do in foreign policy. But my greatest single criticism is the failure to do anything and the failure to act and act in concert with others in response to the Indian nuclear explosion of 1998, which was, in my view, the most irresponsible, I repeat, the most irresponsible act in international relations since the end of the Second World War. They could have thrown the book at them under Article 41 of the UN Charter and much else besides and chose not to do so. The reasons given for India's nuclear breakout are, of course, threadbare, as has been well argued by two former Indian colleagues of mine, Achin Van Eyck and Prafull Bidwai, in their book South Asia on a Short Fuse. Much was made of a supposed Chinese threat, which is completely baseless. Others in India claim that it was making up for centuries or millennia of wrongs committed by outsiders, an argument which could, of course, be used by every country in the world, including Ireland, to justify having nuclear weapons. Now, wise souls and those who believe nuclear weapons stabilize the world argue that deterrence can indeed stabilize South Asia. I had the pleasure of contributing to a recent anniversary issue of the Times of India, only to find that my place on the op-ed page was shared with one Kenneth Waltz, known to all students of international relations as an advocate of nuclear proliferation on the grounds that the more countries which have weapons, the better. Now, such stabilization is fondly to be desired, but there are strong reasons for doubting that it will be the case. First of all, stable deterrence requires firm, established political authority in the countries concerned, and this is signally lacking in India and Pakistan. Secondly, the nuclear peace that reigned in Europe during the Cold War encompassed at least some buffer zone between the main protagonists, Russia in the East, France, Britain, and the USA in the West, and no such buffer state exists in South Asia, where India and Pakistan are butt onto each other. Thirdly, the nuclear peace in Europe entailed an iron curtain, a humanitarian crime, but a guarantee against sudden political crises and unexpected escalations. In South Asia, by contrast, you have Kashmir, which Pakistan irresponsibly and repeatedly seeks to destabilize, and India refuses to conciliate. The third area of instability is the Persian Gulf. Here, too, there has been a history of war from the 1960s through to the 1990s. The wars which we have seen were, of course, arrested by exhaustion or external intervention. And it's also important to say that none of the issues in dispute in the Gulf are intractable. There are no major boundary disputes. There are no Kashmirs or Palestines. Iran and the Emirates, it's true, contest some small islands, but these are hardly inhabited. They are, as Borges said of the British and the Argentinians over the Falklands, like two bald men quarreling over a comb. But the sources of conflict are deep because they lie within the countries themselves, and in particular in the way in which modern nationalism has constructed an interstate competition and a division that has drawn them into war. And this could happen again. The basis of any security system in the Gulf is a degree of trust between the triangle of the three most powerful states, Iran, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia. But until and unless all three have minimal cooperative relations with each other, which they most certainly do not, there is danger of further conflict. The moment American and British forces keep a precarious peace, but there's no guaranteeing how long they will stay, and Iraq, meanwhile, is regaining confidence and freedom of maneuver. And what Saddam tried to do twice before, by invading Iran and then Kuwait, he could certainly do so again. As for Iran, the emollient moves of its political leadership have not prevented it from pursuing a security policy which would be rational for any state in its neighborhood to pursue. If you sit in Tehran, you see Afghanistan to the east, you see a nuclear Pakistan to the southeast, you see a reviving and potentially dangerous Iraq to the west, you have Russia with all its problems to the north, you have Israel further away, and in those circumstances, I think it would be inconceivable that any prudent Iranian government did not pursue a weapons of mass destruction program, even if at a relatively slow pace. These three dangers of interstate war in the Far East, South Asia, and the Gulf are, however, accompanied by broader menacing trends in the international context, the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction and the accompanying erosion or even breakdown in the non-proliferation regimes built up over the latter part of the Cold War. India and Pakistan's nuclear policies in 1998, the US congressional rejection of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty in 1999, a growing commitment by US politicians, not least George Bush Jr., to national missile defense, all betoken a much more dangerous world. National missile defense is supported by the overwhelming majority of the American population, and it is coming, whatever Mr. Blair, Mr. Chirac, the editorial writers of the European press may think. The opposite end of the spectrum, we have the spread throughout the world of masses of small weapons uncontrolled by states or by strategic regimes. These may not cause wars, but they most certainly facilitate an encouragement, as is evident in the Balkans, the Transcaucasus, in Northern Caucasus, in Central Africa, in Colombia. The oldest spectre of all, therefore, war, is far from being banished from the international scene. And we have not, of course, discussed what surprises might come our way. The second great challenge in policy terms facing the world today is, of course, that of global economic insecurity between and within states. There is a tendency, and more than that, in much current coverage of globalization, to assume that the major economic problems of the world have in some ways been solved, that all we need to do is have more of the same. But in certain fundamental respects, this just ain't so. I'm not going to discuss, because it's predictive, and anyway I'm not competent to discuss it, the question of whether we've come to the end of long-term cycles in production of the kind that has beset the capitalist system for the last 200 years. All I would say is it's far too early to be sure that this is in fact the case. But I want to focus on three other aspects of globalization as far as the economy is concerned, which could have immense international, social, and political consequences. The first is a chronic and, in my view, increasingly dangerous problem about employment. For much of the past 200 years, we've seen a situation in which, above all through industrialization, technological and economic growth, employment has increased. This was the motor of urbanization and of migration. But what we see today is not only a decline in the two most important historical forms of employment, agriculture and industry, but a growing gap between the achievements of technological change and the potential for employment. Quite simply, the world does not need the labor force that it has, and we're looking, let's remind ourselves, at a world of 10 billion people by the year 2050. For some parts of the developed world, Europe and Japan, the problem is that of a labor shortage. But this is not the issue worldwide. The problem worldwide is growing unemployment and underemployment. Job creation, by fair means or foul, is becoming a major social and political challenge worldwide, perhaps the major challenge within countries of the 21st century, and it is one which the current phase of scientific and technological change does little to address. Talking not long ago to a former government official in Algeria, what can the West do to help solve the problem in Algeria? He said, you can solve the problem in Algeria by telling us how to employ 15 million young people. And that answer could be given for over 100 countries in the world. Secondly, we have something intrinsic to the current organization of the world economy, though not, I would argue, to capitalism itself, which is the instability of financial and currency markets. And this is exacerbated by the very increase in the volumes of money traded, the weakness of financial institutions in many countries, and, I would argue, the very irrationality and insecurity of speculative frenzy. The grotesque spectacle replicated day after day in the global casino of grown men and women screaming and sweating and yelling into their mobiles as they play with the welfare of billions of people. A frenzy, of course, now accentuated by the communications revolution. In the past decade, there have been significant banking crises in over 125 countries. The IT revolution has encouraged an overstimulation of stocks that itself leads to greater market swings. The consequences of this are many, but one of great significance for North-South relations is how vulnerable this leaves private capital flows to the third world, which fell from $213 billion in 1996 to $60 billion in 1998. The greatest insecurity in the world economy is, however, born of global and rising inequality. The world has always been unequal, but it is becoming more unequal than it ever was before. If the Industrial Revolution and the creation of a single world economy laid the foundations of this, the burst of more recent years, the long post-1945 boom up to the 1970s, and now neoliberal globalization have accentuated it. The record of the 20th century, laid out in the 1999 UNDP Human Development Report, speaks for itself. The gap between the richest fifth of the world's population and the poorest stood in 1820 at around 3-1. In 1913, 11-1. In 1970, at 30-1. In 1990, 60-1. And at the century's end, at 74-1. By 1997, the top 20% of the global population living in high-income countries and who send their children to the LSE generated 86% of world GDP. The middle 60% generated 13%. The bottom 20% produced 1% of world GDP. This inequality in per capita income is replicated in other forms of index. The top 20% countries account for 82% of export markets and 68% of FDI. 50% of the world, I repeat, 50% of the world lives on less than $2 a day. This inequality goes to the heart of the world's use and abuse, not only of goods and of production, but of science and technology, supposedly the harbingers of the new optimistic millennial age. In the field of the environment, we see a growing divergence between the interests, policies, and fears of the rich and poor nations. The environment is supposed to be the very core of the global commons, but of course it has produced even greater global division and rancor. We turn to the two talismans or tokens or fetishes of the new millennium, biotechnology and IT, then of course inequality is what pervades their distribution. The frontiers of medical knowledge are transforming the possibilities of human life, but the inequality in medical provision and in public health policy, which has already created dramatic differences in life expectancy worldwide, are likely further to reinforce global inequality. Developments in biotechnology, be they genetic modification prior to birth or genetic surgery thereafter, run the risk of dividing the world and dividing societies into those who can and those who cannot afford such treatments. We already see this in regard to AIDS, which now afflicts 34 million people worldwide and is the fourth largest cause of death in the world. Those infected by HIV can have its effects mitigated by a cocktail of retroviral drugs, but that cocktail costs over $10,000 a year, something the many millions of sufferers in poor countries, 90% of the total of sufferers, cannot afford. Only $300 million is being spent worldwide on AIDS vaccine research. Why? So we are told by The Economist, no less, because there is no incentive for drugs companies to cure something that is predominantly found in poor countries. For its part, the IT revolution is, if anything, set to increase inequality as well by creating an information-rich and an information-poor divide. The OECD countries account for 91% of all internet users. And even those who get onto the IT escalator will discover that it has many layers and that the top layers are often moving faster, even as they struggle with the bottom steps. This issue of global economic inequality and instability is, next to war, the most enduring and morally compelling on the international agenda. Modernity has not solved it and has in some ways made it worse. We have seen in modern times two ambitious, if crude, attempts to redress the problem. From 1870 to 1945, we had colonialism. From 1945 to 1990, we had the experiment by around 20 countries in authoritarian communism. Both sought, in their brutal modernist way, to transform relations between rich and poor countries, and both have now, after enormous cost, been discarded. Question remains as to whether this third attempt, subsumed under the term globalization, can do any better and at less human cost. The third of the great challenges facing the world today is that of democracy. In much of the literature, we encounter a positive, broadly liberal argument with an important international implication. According to this argument, democracy is the highest, implicitly final stage of political development and the one that is most compatible with other goals, notably economic growth, and of great import to any international survey, compatible with peace. Democratic states, we are told, not only fulfill desirable political goals and protect rights, they also bring wealth and, very importantly, international security. And in the aftermath of the Cold War, it's argued, the argument for liberal democracy has been won. There are no global contenders. With all sorts of hiccups, democratization is spreading across the world. In a phrase of Hegel's, which Fukuyama particularly likes, all that is left is the realignment of the provinces. This liberal argument is not entirely baseless. Democracy is in some form or another the most desirable political form. It has shown itself to be compatible with economic liberalism and with growth. And Fukuyama is right, much abused, but I think he's right, in arguing that there is no global ideological rival at the moment. Nationalism is not a rival ideology, religious fundamentalism is neither global nor in any economic sense an answer. In fact, in all the books on economic fundamentalism, in Islamic fundamentalism or any other fundamentalism, you never find a chapter on economics because they've got nothing to say. Khomeini's great saying that economics are for donkeys, human beings are made for higher things. The argument on democracy and peace also has much validity, both on a priori grounds to do with the reluctance of constitutional states to go to war and on the historical record. It is sustainable that democracies do not go to war with each other. This is of great significance. A world in which there was broadly distributed prosperity and established liberal democracy, a globalized, perhaps very boring, but nevertheless a prosperous and happy, as it were, globalized European Union, would be one in which the specter of war would be remote. The point is, however, we're a very long way from it indeed. First of all, it's simply untrue to say that the system of politics we have in the developed countries is here to stay. It may be, but it would be folly to assume that it is so. Political systems, like buildings, need maintenance. If they don't get it, they start to crumble and fall down. And this leaves aside what the more unruly occupants themselves may do. Nobody looking at the state of democracies in the developed world today should be at ease. You see falling levels of electoral participation in the United States, almost universal scandal and concern with the distortions of the electoral process and the government process by money and financial backers, a declining level of political literacy on many fronts, widespread disregard by younger people for political life, and last but not least, a rather extreme paucity of credible and admirable political leaders in developed and in other countries. If we extrapolate these trends over the next 2 or 4 decades, the edifice could be very shaky indeed. We should not assume that democracy will continue to last forever in the absence of renewal and reform. If we then come to the question of how far democracy has spread, an element of caution is also necessary. I would argue that you cannot argue a democracy is established unless it has been there for a period of time, a generation, say 25 or 30 years. And while of the 195 states in the world, up to 100 may, on some criteria, be classified as democratic, the number who pass the test of time and who have real alternation of office holders is much, much fewer. The OECD states, India, Australasia, parts of the Caribbean, perhaps 40, at most 50 states in all. Many others are or may be in transition to democracy, but the word transition has fooled many people in recent decades, and perhaps they're in transition to nothing. Perhaps they're in transition to what you've got. Semi-democratic, semi-authoritarian states, where there is an appearance of electoral power and alternation, but which are in fact controlled by dictators or oligarchs. Now, this uneven spread of democracy is pertinent above all to the question of peace. If so many countries in the world are not democratic, and may well not become so in the near future, then the risks of war are high. It has indeed been convincingly argued that the most dangerous states are not dictatorships at all, but states in the process of democratization. Passions run high, leaders lack control, social and economic tensions may be extreme. In this regard, we can just mention 3 countries where the tensions of democratization are particularly strong. One is Russia. Second is China, and the third is Indonesia. These countries are a long way from achieving stable democratization. They're a long way from resolving the problems which they confront. I was asked an intriguing question recently by a Spanish-speaking radio television station at the time of the Russian elections. Try to explain, the question was, to a Latin American audience, whether people in Russia are better off than on average people are in Latin America. And my gut feeling, which I can't articulate, was, of course, that people in Latin America are much better off than people are in Russia. There is, in most Latin American countries, a strong state. There is a degree of civil society. Even with the exception, perhaps, of Colombia, there isn't the degree of lawlessness which there is in Russia. And yet, paradoxically, this is a strange outcome at the end of the 20th century or the beginning of the 21st. As far as China is concerned, it could be, and we would all be confounded if it was, that the system of one-party rule can continue and maintain some kind of order and consensus, perhaps even increasing consensus, as the economy changes. But it defies everything that history and social science have told us, that in fact this can continue indefinitely. So much for 3 of the challenges that we face: the question of war, the question of the global economy, the question of democracy. Now to the question of global governance. The mechanisms that we have to deal with these problems have been subsumed in recent years under the term global governance, a term which many of my colleagues didn't like when it was first introduced, but which we have come happily to live with. Governance is meant to imply that the management of world affairs is not carried out by one government, but by a range of institutions, some with distinct competences, some with overlapping competences, but also that this governance is carried out in according to some principles of what are termed good governance. The multiplicity of institutions is, of course, very striking. In some countries, you have organizations falling over each other. If you take peace and security in Europe, you've got at least seven organizations, all responsible for peace and security in Europe. You've got the UN, you've got NATO, you've got the Council of Europe, you've got the WEU, you've got the OSCE, you've got the Partnership for Peace, and you've got the European Union. Global governance also creates a greater depth than might have been present in the past with one supranational authority, in the sense that we now have the participation of NGOs, we have civil society, and so forth. And I would argue that the system of global governance can be seen at least four levels: the level of the supranational organizations and international institutions like the UN and the EU, below them the traditional and enduring and still extremely important repositories of political power and legitimacy, states. Below these lies civil society in its broadest sense, within and between countries. And finally, and too easily forgotten in an age of structures, communities, global trends, and all the rest of it, is the basis of the whole story, the individual, all 6 billion plus of them, or rather of us. Global governance is, therefore, something that is here to stay. And the challenge is not to throw it out the window, nor reject the possibility of it being reformed. The international system needs governance. It needs regulations. If the human rights regime represents imperialist or ethnocentric or post-Christian particularities and interests, then it can and should be reworked to be more equal, less self-serving, and more effective. But it should not be junked. The same goes for rules for investment or for trade. If they are one-sided, then we should have different rules. But a world without any rules at all is not, in my view, desirable. Yet here, as in so much of international affairs, the desire for reform can and does easily slide into another promotion of myth. To each of the levels of global governance, institutions, states, civil society, individuals, there corresponds a certain degree of misconception. And these stalk the current discussion of global governance and its interrelationship with globalization. The first of these concerns the durability of the governance system itself. Here again, there's no reason to assume that it can or will endure indefinitely. The system of global governance we have today has been built up mainly since World War II. It has managed security, trade, and much else besides. It has created a body of international law. It has arrested and brought to some kind of book even General Pinochet, despite the fact that he returned home in the end. But it's not in the best of shape. From below, there is enormous skepticism about the European Union. This is far from being a uniquely British problem. Just look at press coverage Europe-wide of the affairs of the European Parliament. It doesn't happen. There is nothing inevitable or final about the development of the European Union. It is a human institution. It could last, but it might not. We should be aware in the post-Cold War world of what I've elsewhere termed the single transferable utopia. And it sometimes looks as if the EU has become the beneficiary of this idealism, but without the basis for it sustaining it. And if we, I think, put ourselves in these weeks in the shoes of our distinguished alumnus, Mr. Romano Prodi, he, above all, has been reminded rather brutally in recent weeks that it is the powerful states, not the states as a whole, but the powerful states in the European Union, rather than the Commission, which caused the shots on many questions. If we're asked to think forward a decade or two for new academic programs, or ones we might open a tentative file on, I always suggest the breakup of trading blocks. I hope it doesn't happen. It is not inevitable that it will, but some caution about the future might be in order. Same goes for the United Nations, defied and abused as much as it is respected. If we take the example of UN peacekeeping, it was in fine form over the Kuwait crisis of 1990-91, but took a steep dive there afterwards in Somalia, Rwanda, and Bosnia. And other institutions, namely the IMF and the World Bank, have also come in for their share of criticism from the right and from the left. Secondly, we have the cornerstone of the system to date, states. The international governance system is necessarily driven and defined by its more powerful states. The question is not whether this is desirable or not. In many ways, it's not. But the question is whether that power will be used or can be used in a more or less responsible manner. Indeed, the greatest challenge facing global governance today is, as Tony Giddens implied in his introduction, and as Meghna Desai has often pointed out, the same as in 1914. It is whether disagreement between states will destroy the system of cooperation which exists. The globalization of the period before 1914 was not destroyed from below. It was destroyed by the folly and rivalry of those from above. And here we see many signs that this rivalry is continuing. I shall talk in the next lecture about the United States. But it's worth noting what happened on the inside at Seattle. The myth of Seattle is that somehow a network of global protesters and ruckus makers stopped the WTO in its tracks. They certainly sought to do that. But the fundamental reason why the Seattle conference failed was because the states inside could not agree on what to do. Europeans could not agree with the Americans, and third world states such as India, Brazil, and Egypt could not agree with the OECD as a whole. This, not what was happening on the streets, was the main game in town. At the center of all these institutions lie the more powerful states, the permanent members, of whom the United States is the leading one, and the question, perhaps the greatest question, confronting global governance and confronting the WTO is whether the disputes between them on economic as well as security matters can be resolved in a diplomatic and legal manner or not. When we come to the third level, that of global civil society, a similar caution may be in order. There is something that can legitimately be termed a global civil society, a network of NGOs and liberal groups who are pushing governments and public opinion for change. The work of Amnesty International, Greenpeace, Oxfam, and others embodies that kind of campaign. On some issues like debt relief, anti-personnel mines, the environment, global civil society has made a major impact. But the powers of civil society, separate from states, should not be exaggerated. NGOs can, on occasion, challenge specific actions of multinationals. They can do little to alter broader patterns of investment, trade, or employment. NGOs can protest at violence and militarism, but when the killers get to work, civil society is too easily swept aside. Look at the paralysis of civil society in Northern Ireland over the last 30 years. Look at the fate of civil society in the Basque Country, despite the ability to mobilize tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people in the streets. Look at the way in which the many decent and courageous people of inter-ethnic collaboration were swept aside in Bosnia, on the streets of Sarajevo in 1992, and in Kosovo later on. Moreover, an element of caution about the claim to be civil is needed. All that is not state is not liberal. The mafia, the narco-traffickers, anti-immigration fanatics would all claim to be part of global civil society. NGOs are as liberal, democratic, civil as the causes they support and the internal governance structures they themselves espouse. Global civil society cannot be a substitute for the democratic and effective work of states. What states do is influenced by civil society, but the latter cannot replace them. Finally, the individual. It is on the decisions of individuals, their level of education, their knowledge and responsibility, and on their ability to cooperate and act that the whole edifice of global governance rests. If they are not supportive, if they are not informed by a critical and adult press, if their assumptions about politics, domestic and international, are not tested and their idols challenged, then the whole thing could come tumbling down. It's happened before, it could happen again. It's not history or fate or structures or science that is going to shape the world at 2000. It's conscious, responsible, organized individuals. Here, indeed, there is a worrying feature of the millennium as we have seen it. If there is one major contrast that I would draw attention to between the world of 1900 and the world of 2000, it's a difference of zeitgeist. In the former, there was a strong sense of a limitless, certainly overstated, but limitless progressive belief in the possibility of human beings to change the world, above all through conscious, purposive, and collective human agency. The spirit of this millennium is much more passive and deterministic, faith in the beneficial potential of scientific and technological development, a faith in particular in the three fetishes of our age, the market, the microchip, and the genome. And much of public discussion, and not a little academic debate, are shaped by recourse to these three much more deterministic forces, which in some combination are believed to prepare the basis for the emancipation of humanity and the improvement of our condition. I think this is mistaken, and I think we have lost something in the intermittent 100 years. We have to start by understanding how the world works and what we can do to influence it, but not at the cost of losing sight of the capabilities of human agency. That, indeed, is the biggest challenge facing us all, and of course it is the biggest challenge facing those of us in the privileged field of education. In this sense, Schiller's injunction to be both a citizen of one's country and of one's age was never more relevant than it is today. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to open this to questions from the floor now. For about 5 or 10 minutes, not too many. When I indicate that we're going to take your question, if you could wait until my colleague with the radio microphone reaches you. I have a colleague on the left who will bring you the microphone. Please speak clearly into the mic and hold it about this sort of distance. Okay, who wants to be first? I shouldn't have phrased it that way, should I? Okay, at the back.
Thank you. Can you hear me? Am I using it correctly?
That's okay.
Yes. Thank you for your really stimulating talk. I'd like to ask a question. One difference, I would say, from you comparing 1900 to 2000 is what didn't exist then, but exists now, are what I call a whole lot of kind of political spiritual movements, which, well, you know, you didn't use the phrase, but it's used as much as globalization. That's the new age. Now, some people think that's a lot of rubbish, you know, fads and palaces, which are no realistic, but there are, we do see this impact. I think of the Falun Gong movement in China. I mean, I see leaflets about this Falun Gong in London, so we don't need to travel too far to learn. But throughout the world, in India, there seems to be, you know, so many gurus and spiritual movements with their Western adherents. America's full of them, and we've got them in England. I'd like, be very interested to know what you would say about this phenomenon. I would say it's a fairly new phenomenon. This type of thing didn't exist in 1900. We had world wars. But we do have it now, and I feel that's growing. I'd be interested to know what you might think, how this would influence the international relations of the future.
Well, that's a new one. Let me go into standard globalization reflex, which is how new is this really? I'm not in favor of saying nothing has changed, many things have changed, but just thinking back to 100 years ago, you had the Boxer Uprising in China, for example, which was a kind of religious sect of enormous nationalistic and social potential as well. You certainly had all sorts of evangelical and spiritual movements here. You had Madame Blavatsky and her Theosophists up the road in near Russell Square. The particular form of groups that we see today, many of them are syncretic and new, and the Falun Gong is a new example. But A, I wonder how novel this is, and I leave it entirely open. And secondly, what is the effect of these on politics or social life in general? Despite the rise of these movements, I think we're living in a society that is more and more secular in general. Even in those countries where you see movements of religious fundamentalism, their main programs are often ones to do with political power and the retention of social economic power. So I leave it open how far this is a fundamental difference between now and the year 1900. But that belief in alternative worlds of some kind will continue and is recurrent in all societies in the world and strikingly emerging in a society which hitherto was not dominated, certainly by any orthodox form of religion, namely China, is a significant feature of the modern world.
Thank you. I think that those of us, Fred, who had problems with the idea of global governance were simply interested and continue to be interested in what the added value of the term is in sense of the... It obviously operates in the middle ground between anarchy and society in terms of Hedley Bull's famous formulation. But how far is that actually different from the notion of system? I mean, if you look at the the four levels that you adumbrated in terms of individuals, civil society, the state, and international institutions, and so on. Those can be perfectly well seen as part of interlocking levels or subsystems which constitute varying degrees of organization in the world. None of us believe that we live in a completely random, unstructured world. But the idea of governance, even though it's weaker than government, still seems to imply that somehow these things are mutually reinforcing and that there is an element of congealing and perhaps socialization involved. And as you well know, there are lots of arguments against that position.
Thanks. Well, I wonder whether it is to be assumed that they are congealing or reinforcing, precisely because, in my view, one of the two key assumptions of the term global governance and of the literature over the last 10 years is the breaking down of an aspiration to a single world government. I mean, getting away, most obviously, from the idea of the UN system as the focus of everything. And don't forget that, as we know, that even institutions which are not normally regarded as part of the UN system, like the IMF and the World Bank, are in fact part of it. Whereas, of course, now the WTO, to give one obvious example, is not even formally part of the UN system. So is it about convergence or is it about multiplicity? And the example I gave of the security organizations in Europe is, I think, a further case. Whether this is a good thing or a bad thing, even at the level of interstate organizations, which all those seven European security organizations are, or whether they pass the buck or fall over each other or make a mess of things, as arguably happened in Bosnia, is an open question. So I'm not sure that convergence is implicit in the concept of governance. I think it's more that, A, that there is a diversity and multiplicity of institutions. And if we look at the economic system, we have the Bank of International Settlements, we have things which are not really even organizations at all, like the Group of Seven, but are quite effective. So I think it signals that diversity. But secondly, there is much greater emphasis, as you know better than I, on the principles of organization of these institutions themselves, on good practice, on transparency, on various forms of staff assessment and all the rest of it. In other words, governance assumes a critical tone with regard to these institutions, saying they simply can't go on running in the old way. They've got to be assessed and reassessed, and there have to be criteria by which they operate. And that might include even closing some of them down. Is it the same as system? Well, not by my understanding of the word system. If by system is merely meant a description of the way in which states and other institutions interact, I mean, there is an aspiration to have both a multiplicity of institutions and also a reasonable governance principles implemented in them and reasonable forms of assessment. And I'd add to that, of course, the third point which you alluded to, which is that the governance system implies some kind of relationship, a tension or a cooperation or a rivalry, but some kind of relationship of an ongoing kind between interstate organizations and the institutions of civil society. And that, I think, the greater recognition of the potential for NGOs and all sorts of other interest groups to be related to not just national but international state organizations or interstate organizations does mark a shift from what was there before. So will it work? Will it be more effective than the global government structure? Will there be multiplicity of institutions falling over each other is anyone's guess, and I think we can all think of cases where in fact they have all fallen over each other. But that it is something different, I don't think is from my point of view a problem.
Although it's very difficult to make generalizations, I would say that 100 years ago, international affairs as such was in the hands of informed opinion. Not many people were very interested in international affairs. Now, nowadays, international affairs as such are projected into the lunchrooms of many people via mass media. And my question is, generally speaking, the impact of mass media on international affairs itself, is it stabilizing? Are mass media a stabilizing or destabilizing force in the conduct of international affairs generally, for politicians, for well-intentioned politicians in the democracies? Well, what is your view about the role of these mass media? in the stabilization or destabilization of the system of international affairs?
Well, I would enter the caution which I gave before, which is that for people who live in Britain or the United States or Canada, one or two other countries, it may have appeared as if 100 years ago societies were insulated from the outside world. But for most people in the world, they were living under various forms of colonial rule or foreign domination of one kind or another, or had done so in recent times. And therefore, the degree, if not at the level of everyday interaction, but the degree to which their own societies were shaped by external factors, their politics or economics, sometimes they exaggerated the extent to which it was, is something which I think is important not to forget. So yes, it wasn't with the immediacy of the mass media of today, but the context in which those societies and peoples operated was very much one of being subject to external constraints and external influences and all the rest of it, as well as to the vagaries of integration into the world economy, whether it's in India or in Argentina or in China or wherever it might be. On the question of the mass media, the potential is there for the mass media to perform the role of informing people and of providing an area in which different views can be heard and all the rest of it. My worry is not so much the immediacy, the point you made, or that may be a problem, but it's the fact of the level of what they're being provided with and the decreasing responsibility of mass media. Let's take Britain and the United States as examples because it's well documented, about informing people about external factors, about giving them a reasoned background against which to make judgments. How can you have an informed debate about whether or not to intervene in Kosovo or send troops to Kosovo if the level of coverage anterior to that has been so small and the level of debate about the issues has been so small? How can we have an informed discussion about migration if the things are covered in this way? And one could go down some of the other issues that I mentioned. So it may be a pet theme of mine, but it's been well documented by others, and I think that the lack of responsibility by the press and following the press by television with regard to these international issues is a very worrying part about the nature of international civil society and the ability of societies generally to play a responsible role internationally. And just take the practical example. This country is a member of the Security Council. It's one of the permanent five members. Article 24 of the UN Charter says very clearly that the permanent five have special responsibilities for the maintenance of international peace and security. That means sending troops to peacekeeping operations. How can you have an intelligent national discussion of these responsibilities if issues are not taken much more seriously by the press than they are, and people are not better informed, and people are not taught about them in schools, which they're not. No British schools tells people what you ask the UN Association, how many British schools actually educate people in, you know, what it is to be a member of the UN, let alone a permanent member of the Security Council? So that the ability to respond positively or negatively is constrained by what people are given through the educational system and through the press. Having said that, I wouldn't want to ascribe causation or responsibility to the press for what may be much broader issues. I think the ability of the press to influence public opinion on specific issues is often overstated. You take a classic example. Was it press coverage of the Kurdish refugees fleeing northern Iraq in the spring of 1991 which led to the intervention, humanitarian intervention on behalf of the Kurds in northern Iraq? Or was it, you know, a good statist argument? Was it the Turkish state bringing up and saying, wait a minute, we don't want all these Kurds coming into Turkey. You've got to keep them in Iraq, and the only way to keep them in Iraq is to have a humanitarian operation. Now, what I'd say is the evidence suggests that the second was quite important, but the nice story is it was people seeing this on the television. Secondly, and this goes back to my point about the partial nature of globalization, we get pictures from some places, but we sure ain't seen much live footage of human rights violations in Afghanistan in recent years. We know it's going on, but we ain't seen it. Much of what emerged in Chechnya emerged much later. By dint of the fact that if there is no film, there is no story, and if there is no story, there is no indignation, we're getting a very selective world. I don't have a magic wand solution for it, but I think that's another part of the problem. But I certainly think that in this country, the people responsible for both the printed press and the television are failing in what is a public responsibility. And to give you a very simple example, Michael Ignatieff was commissioned by one of the main television stations here to do a series of 5 films about the United Nations on the 50th anniversary of the UN. We're done. And then the director of that channel, a media studies graduate, by the way, said, nothing in the world bores me more than the United Nations. So he canceled 4 of them. They just showed 1, which is a rather nice but inconsequential film about Boutros Ghali going around Africa on a plane and he went to see Mobutu. That was all. That was all they showed. And you can replicate this several times over. So I think it is a failure to inform which makes it much more possible for idiots and demagogues and paranoids and so on. Let's have 1 more question and we've got to stop.
Okay. Into the back.
I was just going to ask how much of that failure to inform was based on lack of people's desire to know.
Sorry, could you repeat the question? Yeah.
You were arguing that a lot of that responsibility lied within the media for a failure to form, but if the media is market-driven, then the people watching it would not want to know it, or they're, you know. So the question comes back to you as how much of the failure to inform is based on a lack of people's desire to hear?
Well, I wouldn't take desire to hear as a given. I mean, people in most countries in the world want education, for example, for one reason or another. And part of education is a desire to know. It may not be for the beauty of the knowledge, it may be for the pay packets they'll get or the people they'll meet or whatever. But there is, Tony Giddens always says, you know, there are 2 things in the world that people are most concerned about these days, which are health and education. And I'm willing to believe him on this. And certainly the evidence suggests that the number of people trying to get into the LSE or the number of people who value education worldwide and are struggling to get some education is enormous. So I wouldn't want to say there is a static failure to want to know. Secondly, as with appreciation of music or understanding a language or ability to cook or dance the tango or whatever it is, it partly depends on your curiosity itself or ability to be interested in things is a function of education. So that the education of people is both a function, both a result of educational establishments, but equally of the press. And if people are told more and told more in certain ways, I think they'll get more interested. Of course, it's an uphill struggle. But that, I mean, I would argue that the press has a responsibility and that it's failing and that the press drives the television media. Do I think most people in the world want to study international relations all the time? No. But we could do a bit better than we do.
Okay. All right. I'd like to thank Fred for that lecture. That was fascinating. I've always been of the opinion that he's the most interesting lecturer here at LSE. Hope that doesn't offend too many people here present, but he's advanced that further tonight. We're back here again at Tuesday next week, and the topic next week is the future of American power. I'd like to thank so many of you for turning up on the first night of term. It's often a quiet night, so it's good to see so many people here tonight. Excerpts of this tonight are going to be available on fathom.com. There's going to be highlights going up in June, and you can access that through the LSE events website as well. And I'd like to thank Macmillan for their support, and they've got a range of books on sale in the foyer from Fred and other authors that are 20% off tonight. So thanks a lot, and hope to see you next week.